From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Healthcare reform has been both pilloried and praised since it became law in March 2010. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, has become a political football, and the Supreme Court weighed in on it earlier this year. But questions remain. What should be done to deliver medicine more reliably and affordably for all Americans? Can partisanship be set aside on such a polarizing issue? A panel discussion featuring a variety of viewpoints was held at the City Library last night, and today on the program we're bringing you parts of that conversation. Plus, local author Muffy Mead Farrow joins us to talk about big skies, wide open spaces, and lessons learned growing up on the Wyoming range. Her new memoir, Its Head Came Off by Accident. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The Affordable Care Act has been hotly debated since it was signed into law in March of 2010, and last night a panel of experts took the so-called Obamacare conversation beyond the standard political rhetoric during a community forum. Healthcare reform, medicine myths and realities held here at the City Library. Today on the program, we're bringing you some excerpts from that conversation. Later on in the show, a conversation with Muffy Mead Farrow about her new memoir, but first, health reform. On the panel, Judy Hillman with the Utah Health Policy Project, a nonprofit that works for comprehensive health coverage for all Utahns. Dr. Norm Waitzman, a professor of economics at the University of Utah. Stan Rasmussen from the conservative think tank Sutherland Institute. And Dr. John C. Nelson, an OBGYN and a senior advisor at Levitt Partners, a healthcare consulting firm. The goal of the Affordable Care Act is, of course, to extend health coverage to the 50 million Americans who are uninsured. And I asked the panelists if the law can achieve that goal. First, Dr. Nelson.
The last estimate I read just a couple of days ago would be that in the year 2015, there will still be 30 million people uninsured after Obamacare has been implemented. So it seemed to me it's not terribly effective. I really respect the president for bringing the power of the Oval Office to this issue. And I think that the debate was healthy. I am a little concerned about having anyone vote for a 2,700-page bill that no one ever read. That's a little concerning. I hate to tell my grandchildren I voted for that, but that's a bit of a concern. But it seems to me that we have a circumstance here where I'm going to buy a car for you. The car I've chosen to buy for you is an Edsel. And you and I are now going to debate whether the best way to pay for that Edsel is to go to the bank and get a loan or whether we should pay cash. We're spending more time talking about the payment than we are about the Edsel. So there's got to be more, in my opinion, much more focus on the delivery system itself and not just the payment system. Certainly the payment system is a motivator, and I understand the idea there. But it seems to me it's a fairly inefficient way to deal with it, and I believe it's dealing with the wrong place.
Judy, 30 million still uninsured in 2015 under the current scenario. So is the law...
Wait a minute.
Does it work? Do you believe that number?
No, I mean, I think you have to sort of look at the scale of it, and you have to look at over the first several years of reform, it'll cover about 70% of the uninsured. So 70% of that 50 million would be covered. It does take some time, in fact, some years to scale up. Part of why you had the delay from passage of the law in 2010 to implementation of the coverage expansions in 2015 is that we had to set up these exchanges. They're supposed to be this one-stop shop where people can go and see all the insurance products on offer, and they're all forced by market changes to compete over the right things, like keeping us healthy, and not over the wrong things, like avoiding risk. Those kinds of insurance market reforms all had to be in place so that you could have this new marketplace. On top of that, the exchange has to allow this sort of seamless eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP. If you plug in your income and household information and you're shopping on that exchange, you may find out that, in fact, you're eligible for Medicaid and CHIP. So it really is a house of cards, and that takes time to fully implement. But when it's fully implemented, it is unfortunate that only 70% of the population would be covered. There are certain groups that were sort of systematically excluded. Undocumented immigrants were excluded. Even legal immigrants who came in after a certain period, it's still a state option to cover those folks or not. So there's also an expectation that with the very minimal penalty that was built into the law, the penalty that people would pay if they go against the mandate, you had to have that mandate. Does everyone understand that you had to have that mandate? It's not that we like to force people to do things, but you need the mandate to bring younger people into the system to offset the costs of older people, older, sicker people who are going to have to use the insurance. All of those changes had to come into place. So that's why, with that mandate, even with that mandate, there's still going to be plenty of young people out there who are going to pay that penalty. So it accounts for that as well. So it's unfortunate, but as I understand it from the countries that have come before us and have done comprehensive reforms on this scale, is that it is definitely a learning process. You'll see Germany, every five or six years, Germany goes into another round of fine-tuning their reforms. No one got it right the first time, and neither will we. What I look forward to, again, is the day when we can have more bipartisan engagement in this so we can sort of tackle the rest of the equation and create reforms that make sense and that resonate for the whole community.
It's still an Edsel.
Dr. Waitzman, so even when fully implemented, you're only covering 70%. I mean, what more would you like to see in this law? Why was it drafted the way that it was?
There are holes in this bucket. And so basically, we're arguing about 5 million people. When you talk 70% of 50 million, that's 35 million people. With 15 million uninsured and up to 30 million uninsured. And there is some transition period with respect to the extent of the penalties under the system for not signing up for health care insurance when you're between 138 and 400% of the poverty line. There are going to be penalties lodged on anybody who's out of the insurance market to have to pay in their taxes, and that basically ramps up over time. So you're going to see people start to participate from 2015 on to 2020 at a higher rate, I think, as Judy pointed out. But it's fair to say that there are millions of people that are left out. And the way that that's going to be addressed is through the continual revisiting of the way in which the system is organized. There's two facets by which people mainly are going to be covered. One is through so-called Medicaid expansion, which actually now states can opt out of based upon the Supreme Court decision. And so the degree to which that's actually going to occur is part of the reason why we're going to have less, potentially 2 to 3 to even 5 million people less participating than would have if the entire law were upheld. The other piece that we have incredible expansion on is through the exchange and through the participation in the exchange. And there's incentives for small businesses as well through the tax system to participate. So you're going to have an extension of coverage. Now, I would just argue in terms of the separation, the delineation of system reform from payment reform, consider the following, because they're actually inextricably linked. I don't know if anybody saw Money in Medicine, the PBS show that was on comparing the UCLA system to the integrated system here at Intermountain, which played a very big role in that documentary. But the cesarean rate, which is an aspect of delivery, is way lower in Utah than it is in UCLA. UCLA pays fee for service. Intermountain is an integrative system which has panels that can override docs with respect to the way that delivery is made. And if anything, the healthcare reform, to some extent, brings us closer to the Intermountain-type system than it does to the UCLA system, partly through payment reform. So it's very important to get into those weeds to dissect how the system is actually going to work on the ground. But the issue of how there's going to be continued extension to the uninsured is an important one.
Stan, do you want to chime in on the coverage question? Is the Affordable Care Act adequate for reaching the uninsured? Based on your opening statement, I would say no. You want to see charities really step up their place at the table.
That's right. I would just concur with what you just said.
All righty, then.
We consider it an unwarranted, inappropriate further intrusion into the healthcare arena by government that does not improve it. That the Medicaid, fortunately, the Supreme Court gave the states the out. Remains to be seen what our governor will do, what other governors will do. But Medicaid, it's just a further expansion of government healthcare. We think there are problems with that conceptually. Based on principle and based on practice.
So Sutherland sees no federal role in reform efforts.
No, I don't know that we would say no federal role, but certainly not the federal role that it's moving toward, which would, appears to be an intent to become a single payer system.
Can I move to costs and maybe ask you? You know, it is called the Affordable Care Act. Is it really affordable? Stan, do you want to chime in on that one?
Well, I've always considered the title an irony and, frankly, a political spin. I guess it depends on who's paying it.
Who is paying it?
Well, it would appear that we're continuing to transfer the payment for services received to somebody else besides the person receiving it.
Judy, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Norm in his opening statement that there's a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, what's in the law in terms of cost containment provisions or payment and delivery system reforms. And, you know, the Congressional Budget Office, you know, always does this thing where they score legislation. They put a price tag on that legislation. And when the original bill came out, you know, 2009, 2010, the score was, again, CBO pretty conservative in their estimates and really only willing to base their score really on savings that you would see mainly through public programs. They have a hard time sort of covering what might go on in the private market. But at the very beginning, the score was that it would be a net savings, that it would about $230 billion, I think, was the original estimate of the savings from implementing the Affordable Care Act. And it's since been sort of revised, that savings estimate is revised downwards a little bit, but then it kind of went in the other direction when they saw the Supreme Court ruling making the Medicaid expansion optional to states, and they recognized that there'd probably be some states that would say no, stupidly say no to the Medicaid expansion, so that obviously saves the federal government a ton of money. Anyway, so it's been kind of a fluid number, but the point is that it is relatively revenue neutral over the first 10 years, and you know, I'll grant you that the main coverage expansions didn't come online until the first 4 years of the reform. But one of the things that I would point out, there's hundreds of pages devoted to cost containment initiatives, payment delivery system reforms that we don't know, we don't have enough experience in this country with those kinds of initiatives to know what kind of real savings those things are going to translate into. So there's a lot of that in the works. And in a nutshell, all you can do, you can't bend the cost curve probably for the next 10 or 20 years, all you can do is slow down the rate of growth in healthcare costs. And the Affordable Care, the Congressional Budget Office says that the Affordable Care Act is doing that, slowing down the rate of growth in the first 10 years. After that, the next 10, maybe the next 10 after that, you know, you try to slow it down even more. But with an aging population, and sort of the changing, you know, the more and more technology and medicine and so forth, it's hard to just bend it like this, but more to slow it down. It does do that.
I agree with Professor Waitzman about the inextricable link between the payment mechanism and the delivery system. That's a very important point.
This is Dr. Nelson.
One has to decide which is chicken and which is the egg on this occasion, because it's important to know they are, in fact, linked. Unfortunately, those 100 pages are in the bill and don't account for a lot of things we have talked about. new technology, which is life-saving, quality-enhancing, and which people want, the aging of the population, new diseases which were not here before, et cetera. And we haven't even begun to talk about genomic medicine, personalized medicine, and things that are available to us in the future. I'm aware of a circumstance right now where a test can predict a person who may go into preterm labor before the person is symptomatic. Every week that a baby stays in the womb is worth $1 billion to the system. This can conservatively save $16 to $20 billion, but the test is going to be $1,000 a person. Who's going to be able to come up with that when we don't have the money? We talk about stupidly not accepting Medicaid. Are you kidding me? For the first time in history, the largest single item in the state's budgets have to do with Medicaid, not with education. It's not stupid to say no. It needs to be considered. It may be the right thing for some states. I'm not here to say yay or nay, but it's got to be considered because there isn't just one item in the budget anymore. There are a lot of things to be considered here. We haven't even talked about the social determinants of health, the things that could be dealt with, good education, good transportation, good nutrition, et cetera. We've got to get all these things put together. And sadly, correctly, Judy has suggested, this has become a partisan issue. There's not a cancer cell, a microbe, or a virus that can tell the difference between a Republican and a Democrat. How this thing has gotten to this point is absolutely beyond me, and I'm embarrassed by it as an American and as a physician. So I hope that we'll call upon each other's gentler side to come up with the things that will help everybody and look for a common solution.
Excerpts from a panel discussion on healthcare reform held at the City Library last night. We'll hear more after a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're rebroadcasting segments of a discussion held last night here at the City Library on healthcare reform. Our experts, Judy Hillman with the Utah Health Policy Project, Dr. Norm Waitzman, professor of economics at the U, and Stan Rasmussen with the conservative think tank Sutherland Institute. Also with us, Dr. John C. Nelson, a doctor and advisor at Levitt Partners, a healthcare consulting firm. The Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, has many elements, including something called independent payment advisory boards, experts who decide which procedures get reimbursed. Critics, of course, have called these boards death panels, and I asked our experts what exactly happens to the doctor-patient relationship under the Obamacare model.
Physician-patient relationship requires incredible trust, but it's a very complex system. I have a friend who's receiving cancer treatment right now, and the oncologist was on the fence as to whether the evidence was there to actually provide the chemotherapy or not. It's a call. And so evidence-based medicine is not something that any particular provider can have command of. And the provider system is made up of many hospitals, systems, and so on, like Intermountain, that will share this information with their docs. Do they override? I indicated they did in terms of the Intermountain system. Are those death panels? Those are, in fact, life panels in some ways, because you're freeing up potentially resources that are going to help other people. And so this is what the Medicare Commission is supposed to do. It's supposed to advise, basically, on things that are being overprovided based upon evidence-based medicine and deliver that through the system as to what Medicare ought to reimburse or not reimburse based upon that evidence. They cannot override the decisions of physicians.
Dr. Nelson and then Judy Hillman.
If you look at the practice of medicine, I envision it as three circles, the first circle being the evidence base, the science that is there, the facts as they are. The second circle is large as the first, overlapping with the first, which is the circle of caring, not just caring for the patient, but caring about that patient. And the third is ethics, same size circle overlapping the other two. That means putting the patient's concerns first always. At the intersection of those three circles of science, caring, and ethics is a patient-physician relationship. I'll point out to you that in a diagnosis being made, 85% of that diagnosis is made by the history. If the history is not being able to be given, how can one make the right diagnosis? You need to remember that a female victim of domestic violence would rather share her victimization with her physician than with any other person. That's something that cannot be given away. About 1930, a fellow by the name of Francis Peabody at Harvard Medical School made a comment that anything that looked good on the surface that interfered with the relationship between patient and physician should be viewed with suspicion. I couldn't agree with him more. That is not to say that there cannot be dramatic change that can improve that relationship. But I cannot go to a patient and say, I'm going to recommend X, Y, or Z, and have someone overshoot me unless that person is willing to take the entire responsibility, medically, legally, morally, and every other way. I can't have it that way, and neither can you as a patient. I think death panels is an unfair characterization. I think it's just a bad idea. It's an intrusion between patient and physician, which is unwarranted and unneeded. If you think not, wait till someone you care about or someone who doesn't know the patient in another place far away is making a decision that is not in the best interest of the patient, but in the best interest of the bottom line. That is untenable.
Judy Hillman.
Well, yesterday when the accusation was made, I think originally by Sarah Palin, that there were death panels in the Affordable Care Act, what she was referring to was this counseling for end-of-life care. You know, there's a lot of expense at the very, very end of life that could be lessened, you know, if we had more appropriate end-of-life care counseling. That's all that was in the Affordable Care Act. It got stripped out because of the politics sort of crowding out on all of that. But with the Independent Payment Advisory Board, I think that is a very important process that's well underway, and it's the way it was explained to me quite a while ago by the folks at Intermountain Healthcare. It's kind of like, if you remember in the 50s, there were more airplane crashes, if people recall, in the 50s, because sometimes the pilot would forget to put down the landing gear. And so they figured out sometime in the 50s that there should be a little buzzer that goes off when you're at a certain altitude. And if you're not putting down your landing gear, you know, you had some explaining to do. Well, it's sort of the same thing with this Independent Payment Advisory Board, really to sort of make sure that there are processes in place to allow evidence-based medicine to guide payment and treatment decisions to the extent possible. The way it works with, you know, if you're in a hospital and you're having a heart attack and you're not getting that aspirin in the first half hour when you're admitted, there may be a valid reason for that. But as far as I understand it, in the Intermountain system, a little buzzer goes off that asks the physician a question. Why are they not getting the aspirin? Why are you not washing your hands? And so on. So that's all that's intended by this. But I think when you think about the 20 to 30% of our healthcare spending that's wasteful, that has no value, I think a lot of that can be minimized with a process to have clinical guidelines guiding, not dictating, but guiding treatment decisions.
That's not apples and oranges, that's apples and kumquats. What you're talking about is clinical care, which is done at the bedside. I think it was Tip O'Neill who said all politics is local. Let me share with you, all healthcare is personal, incredibly so. We can't have people who are not elected, who have no accountability, making decisions at the bedside what they have no right to make, when it's you or someone you care about. That is not American. That's wrong. That part of the Affordable Care Act has got to go.
Stan, do you have anything to
add?
Sure.
I think it's useful to just talk about an issue that we don't really have an answer for, but I think that is playing here in the background and maybe the foreground. We live in this remarkable time of medical technology. Looking at the situation with members of my own family, they're folks that are living now 15, 20 years beyond what they did just a couple of generations ago. As a result, there are more issues that can develop. We have the expectation that it's all going to go well. I remember years ago I was speaking with the director of one of the hospital organizations in the Valley to a community group, and he said, you know, we're at the point where only in America is death considered an option. And he was intending to make, not to be light or make light of an important topic, but to underscore the point that if somebody dies, sometimes the first response is, well, who screwed up? As opposed to, these are normal processes. Well, with that as a background, I think it would be useful, perhaps not tonight, but on another occasion, to talk about the decision process and how that's been, how we've seen this attenuation, the separation occur between the customers, the patients, and the providers. And as wonderful as insurance is, at least in its original concept of mutual benefit and pooled risk and actuarially based pricing, that type of thing that we seem to be moving away from and still use the term insurance, that had an effect of separating the recipient from the decision makers, the people making the decisions from those who are receiving the service. And with government's involvement in healthcare, it just expands that gap. And I think we need to talk about how do we close that gap. Don't use the terms, if you're allergic to the idea of free market processes, just ask yourself, how do we restore that connection between the people who are receiving the service and the decisions made about it and the pricing associated with it, and price and cost, and cost is not always money. But I think there's some important things to talk about that no other generations have had to talk about, because we have this remarkable challenge of the ability to extend life well beyond what other generations have done. And we have expectations that if that technology is available, of course, I want it and everybody should have it. And the cost of it just kind of goes way, way to the margin.
I want to pose a final question to each of you. How does the state of Utah fit into this framework that we have that's called Obamacare? We've got the healthcare exchange. Stan, you mentioned something called the healthcare compact. There's something called Avenue H, which touts itself as this consumer-based approach to health system reform. I'm just trying to figure out how the states fit into this federal equation that we're looking at. And Stan, why don't I start with you?
Thank you. We hope that the state does not fit into Obamacare, because it's our hope that it will be repealed and replaced with something that makes more sense and in a process that does not include 100% Democrats and no Republicans. We would, with respect to the healthcare compact, that's simply a mechanism. A compact is a device, a mechanism, if you will, that has been used about 200 times. All it takes is for two states to adopt similar intentions, and they can declare themselves a compact. This compact now has seven states in it that will expand, and ultimately the intent is that sufficient will be in the compact to approach Congress and negotiate for the return of healthcare authority to the states with the funds to make decisions about what's in the best interest of those states. Comments been made about Romney Care in Massachusetts. You know, if Massachusetts wants that, bully for Massachusetts. That's not a one-size-fits-all, and yet that's kind of what Obamacare has been touted as being. And we believe that each state ought to be able to make its decisions about its people. It knows it better. The people here can administer it better than faceless bureaucrats 3,000 miles away. And we believe that that policy authority and those funds should come here. That's the whole intent of the healthcare compact. That's just a possibility that states are opting into. With respect to how does the state fit in Obamacare, it's our strong recommendation to the governor that he not expand Medicaid, but instead of expanding Medicaid, which is just more government health care, that serious consideration be given to the charity care processes and concept that we've described. And I would just say, to say that it's been tried and it hasn't worked, I think what we're talking about has not been tried, and I believe that it's entirely understandable that people who want to see an expanded role of government would not want to see it tried in a different, better form.
Dr. Weitzman.
There was a major federal subsidy to Romney Care in Massachusetts. I don't know if you knew that, but it was about $300 million that was required in order to
multiply that by 50 and see what happens to the budget deficits. And then let's ask ourselves, we can design all we want about wonder programs, but who's going to pay for it? Will there be funds to pay for it? Or are we all going to be on a charity care basis at some point?
Dr. Weitzman, go ahead.
So the Patient Protection Affordability Care Act is going to reduce the federal budget deficit. It's just like the National Highway Interstate Highway System. You let the states set their own speed limits. There's lots of choice that the states have in order to how they're going to roll this out. But there's an infrastructure here, a framework by which the states can build on. There was a buy-in from nearly every constituency in the country although the ultimate support from the one side of Congress didn't materialize, even though it was a Republican plan in its origin. So we in Utah do face challenges here. There's 100% of the cost of the Medicaid expansion is going to be provided by the federal government through 2016, and then it'll be a phase down to 90% contribution by the federal government by the year 2020. That 10% is not a trivial contribution from the state, and as Dr. Nelson and others have pointed out, there are choices that the states will have to make with respect to their own budgetary decisions. But to not participate at this juncture, we know that one thing hasn't been tried, and that is this Patient Protection and Affordability Care Act. And it would be, I think, it would behoove us as a state to participate, to see how we can articulate and carve out our position in it, to participate in the full capacity, and then to revise it as the flaws become very much apparent.
Judy Hillman, how Utah fits into the big picture?
Well, very awkwardly, because you wonder, why do we have an exchange? Why are we one of two states with functioning exchanges? Now our exchange, as of what, a month ago, our exchange is called Avenue H. They wanted to get that exchange word, which became a curse word, out of it. That's fine. But the reason why we have that is because of that magical time in 2007, 2008, when our leaders were very excited about Romney Care, and they wanted to duplicate it here. So you can imagine how awkward it's been now that Obamacare, modeled on Romney Care, is the law of the land, trying to get this thing implemented when, you know, there is this sort of basic infrastructure. There's no there in the sense that our exchange was not willing. Originally they were, but once, you know, this became kind of a political blood sport in 2008, 2009, and once some of the reform changes got linked to Obamacare, you know, all the stuffing fell out. So our exchange, we have like 67,000 small businesses in Utah. Our exchange covers like 360 small businesses, and a lot of them already offered coverage. So we're not really doing anything to cover the uninsured, and we're not really doing anything to limit cost growth and all the things we're supposed to be good at in Utah. We're not doing that either. We've had a heck of a time trying to get this thing implemented. And you know, I would just look, I don't know what's going to happen in November, but what I look forward to is just a sort of a slow awakening to say, well, how did this exchange get here? How did Avenue H get here? Well, it came from Romney Care. Let's just slow down and look at what's in it, and we'll see that, wow, the private market really is strengthened in these reforms. Remember, at the end of the day, 77% of Utahns will be covered in the private market, and that private market will be strengthened.
Dr. Nelson, I'll give you the last word.
As an obstetrician, I think I'm inherently optimistic. We have the pieces in place in Utah that could be made to work. We have among the lowest costs per capita in healthcare in the nation. We have some of the highest quality healthcare outcomes in the nation. We have integrated systems. We have caring professionals who have worked together over a variety of years. For example, Utah Health Information Network, which is now almost 20 years old because of the cooperation that is here. We have an educated workforce. We have educated patients and so forth. We can do it. A little while ago, we had a very sensitively asked, beautiful question about some of the things we need to do. We need to make sure that the discussion of health system reform is taken in total with all the other things that need to go on in our society. What if we were to take part of the monies and the time to integrate into our school system a comprehensive school-based health education curriculum for public health so that young people would know some of the things that cause disease, know how to eat, know how to exercise and so forth, and actually get into prevention mode and so forth? We are people who care about each other. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I will be seeing some patients on the primary care network. I'm proud to have been part of the group that brought that about. Some people who would not otherwise have care will be seen tomorrow. We'll have some care done. Yes, we have to fill in some of the gaps, and we're trying to do that. I'm sorry I only have half a brain, as I've been told, but I've cared for some of these people for years at no cost because I care about them. But I have two patients to consider, and so do you. First is the individual patient, him or herself, the patient before me. Second is the larger patient, our community. How do we come together? How do we make the decisions that are best for all of us? How do we make the choices be available to us that are going to have effect upon not only us, but the generations yet to come? We need to be very careful about talking about those people. Those people are our brothers and sisters. In one case, it's my son, a graduate student getting a PhD in epidemiology who had Medicaid, and am I glad he did, because his last child born had his heart put in backwards and had to have a $168,000 operation to put the switch back. The kid's doing great, thank you very much. I don't know how this all fits together. What I want to do is to be part of a solution. I hope that my profession can be part of the solution. I hope that I can be part of the solution. To the extent that we've been recalcitrant, I apologize for all of us. Let's go forth together. Let's make this happen. This is the United States of America, and even better, it's Utah. We can get things done. The pieces are here to be in place.
Those are excerpts from a community forum held at the City Library last night. Healthcare Reform, Medicine, Myths, and Reality, sponsored by the Tanner Humanities Center, the Center for Nonviolent Human Rights Advocacy, the University of Utah Program in Health, Society, and Policy, the City Library, and, of course, KCPW. We'll put up the full discussion on our website, kcpw.org, later today. Coming up next, Remembering a Home on the Range. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Muffy Mead Farrow grew up on the frontier, a 6,000-acre ranch near Jackson Hole, Wyoming. In a new memoir, she remembers the quiet lessons she learned from her cowboy parents, and this slacker mom explains why she wants her children to know about the beauty of the West's wide open spaces. Muffy Mead Farrow is the author of three books, including the best-selling Confessions of a Slacker Mom and Confessions of a Slacker Wife. She's been featured on Oprah, The Today Show, and The New York Times. And she lives here in Salt Lake City as well as in Alta, Wyoming. And her recently released memoir is titled Its Head Came Off by Accident. And Muffy Mead Farrow joins me in studio. Muffy, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for having me. You know, you mentioned the title of my book, and I was laughing because I was on your website last night, and I've just been listening to this rebroadcast of the healthcare discussion. And this today's program was titled Alternatives in Healthcare Reform / Its Head Came Off by Accident. And I thought, you know, undoubtedly some people will not realize that these are two different topics.
They are two separate things, folks. Muffy Mead Farrow will be reading from her memoir, Its Head Came Off by Accident, tonight, Tuesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Well, we've got to talk about your title. It's such a great title. Its Head Came Off by Accident. Tell us the story behind this. I guess a bull died on your ranch when you were a kid. And
yes, this did happen.
You and your brothers and some friends had a little experiment.
This did happen from time to time. Well, we had a wonderful family named the Martins that worked for us. They lived on our ranch, but they actually lived a mile north of where I grew up, which at that distance, they were our closest neighbors. And they had a couple of sons. One of them was named Roy Reed. And Roy Reed was a little bit older than we were, but he didn't think of himself as a cowboy, unlike the rest of us. And in spite of all that was going on around him, his bloodline, the expectations of everybody knew, he thought of himself as an Indian from the time that he was little. And he dreamed up many fascinating and sometimes unsuccessful Indian projects for us. And one of them, when this poor, unfortunate bull died out in the pasture, was to skin it the Indian way. Of course, we had teepees and loved to spend a lot of time in the teepees, but we needed floor coverings because they were just on the ground, and this was going to be a fabulous rug for the teepee. And we were going to do it the Indian way, which, according to Roy Reed, was quite simple. Once you made the prescribed cuts around the legs and connected them with a cut around the neck and then all the way down the belly, and then, you know, you're just supposed to be able to grab this hide by the nape of the neck and gradually pull it off. It didn't work at all. We ended up engaging the use of my mother's Jeep Wagoneer, my father's backhoe, ropes, chains, an iron stake about a foot long, a sledgehammer. And keep in mind, I was 10. My younger brother was 8, and my older brother driving the backhoe was 11. Roy Reed, as I said, was a couple of years older, but ultimately things really did go very much awry, and we accidentally beheaded this animal. And that was pretty much the end of the project, because that was the way that we were anchoring it down, was by its head. And once we lost that, then the thing just had to be ended.
It's a great visual. And in the book, you write that a lot of children would have gotten into a fair bit of trouble with their parents on this one. But you knew that you wouldn't be in trouble with the parents. Why not?
Well, that's right. I knew by then, because we'd had quite a number of other projects that we'd done that didn't go well by then. But my parents, you know, we had an unsupervised childhood to some extent. There was no way to childproof a cattle ranch. We had heavy equipment, as I've just described, large animals, irrigation ditches, horses, cattle, all of those things.
6,000 acres.
Yes, and a lot of land to explore. And my parents, to a great extent, gave us a thrilling amount of freedom to discover this world under our own terms to a great extent. And to me, this was a fabulous childhood. But I also knew, as you said, that I wouldn't get in trouble for accidentally taking the head off of this bull, because we had put so much of our own blood, sweat, and tears into this project. And we left the head right by the carcass so that my father could find it when he had to eventually haul the animal off to the bone pile. So we didn't necessarily create any big problems for him. It was just two pieces rather than one. But yes, it was one of those projects that we worked very, very hard on, and that seemed to be the thing that my parents most admired. And I think they encouraged us to be very independent. And you know, Jennifer, I mean, some people see this book as a really hard right turn from my previous books, Confessions of a Slacker Mom, Confessions of a Slacker Wife. Even my agent said to me, she said, you know, the path of your literary career makes no sense. And I was actually really happy to hear that, because it was the first time I'd ever heard anybody suggest that I had a literary career. But she said, you know, Confessions of a Slacker Mom, Confessions of a Slacker Wife are not leading us to think that you're going to now write a Western memoir. But Confessions of a Slacker Mom was, for me, mostly memoir. It's not like I was looking back at all my many years of parenting experience. My kids were 3 and 5 when I wrote that book. Instead, I was thinking about my own mother and my own father and the kind of childhood that I had had growing up on this landscape, this Wyoming cattle ranch. And that was really the inspiration for Confessions of a Slacker Mom. So it was, to me, I am, in
They're
my
related.
Own mind, heading in a logical direction, right?
Speaking with Muffy Mead Farrow, she's the author of 3 books, and her latest is a memoir. Its Head Came Off by Accident. She'll be reading from the book tonight, Tuesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the King's English Bookshop here in Salt Lake City, 15th East and 15th South. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking with Muffy Mead Farrow about her wild exploits on a Wyoming ranch growing up. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So your parents, Pete and Mary, had this, you know, rather hands-off parenting style. They sound like remarkable, hardworking, independent folks, and the photos in the memoir seem to confirm that these are the quintessential cowboys that you envision out on the Wyoming range. Describe your parents for us, if you would.
Well, you know, you're right. It was actually pretty Western. And the way that our cattle operation was when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s was not that different from the way it had been in that same spot under the auspices of our same family 100 years earlier, because it was in the very late 1800s that my great-grandfather came to Jackson Hole and started running cattle there. And you know, of course, I thought it was horribly old-fashioned and that our whole way of life was almost embarrassingly antiquated. Of course, I look back on it now with incredible fondness and only wish that I could go back there and bring my own kids with me. But yes, Pete and Mary, I called them that because I grew up with an extended family of ranch hands. We live right next door to the bunkhouse and the cookhouse. And so I grew up with so many other people that called my parents Pete and Mary, and I'm just explaining that's why we called them that. Nobody objected. But they were very hardworking. It was not a sexist environment. My mother had every bit as much responsibility and authority on this cattle ranch as my father did. They both did a lot of hard labor. They both did the accounting and the books, the hiring and the firing. And we were outdoors most of the time. And it didn't matter if it was good weather or bad, because what needed to be done, you know, whether it was vaccinating or branding or moving cattle or haying, had to be done when it had to be done. And so I am grateful, looking back, that I did grow up with an example and an expectation of hard work. Now, I must say, my parents didn't always explain how to do these things. It was usually, you know, what to do, and not often accompanied by how to do it. Go
so
get the horses.
It out.
Right. Go get the horses into the corral. And then you just have to figure out how. And I don't really know why my parents had such great faith, apparently, in our ability to figure things out for ourselves. But that's the way they treated us. And, you know, I really have tried as much as I can to do that with my own kids, because when I look back, I think, you know, I didn't always figure things out, but being treated like I had the ability to figure things out was a great boost for me. And I know that it made me a more capable human being in the end, and more willing to try things that I didn't necessarily know how to do and that wouldn't necessarily always go right.
That sounds, when you said thinking about antiquated concepts, I mean, we live in an age where there are helicopter parents and dragon moms and parents who really are invested in their kids, making sure that they make the right choices and do everything to get into Harvard. I mean, your parents' concept of parenting must seem like a million miles away.
Well, I guess it does. You know, I guess you could look at it as a good way of getting into Harvard. I mean, that's sort of ironic, but certainly Harvard must be interested in people who can figure things out for themselves, people who have had a lot of opportunities for independent thinking, people who are able to entertain themselves without somebody always telling them what to do. I mean, so I don't know that it is a way or not a way of getting into Harvard or why that might be a goal. It may be or it may not be, depending on the individual. But you're right. I think my parents, even at that time, were probably more hands-off. We were allowed to do so many things that I'm sure a lot of other parents would have looked askance at. Of course, now compare that to today, and it's you know, it's exponentially different, because now I think, unfortunately, so many parents are very fearful. One thing my parents didn't have at that time was the internet. And frankly, we didn't have TV because we lived too far away. And so until we had cable, we didn't actually even have TV. And I think today's parents are so well aware now of everything that can go wrong. And this is starting from the moment of conception. You know, we are so well informed. Some of this is wonderful. Much of it is good. But it is hard, I think, to go forward without fear when you're informed of, you know, every single child abduction that takes place. The fact is, I read in somebody else's book, abductions by strangers, child abductions by strangers are less frequent now than they were in the 1950s. The thing is, we think that it's the opposite, because now every time something like this happens, we know about it. As a mother, you feel it, you know, in your own heart. You're hurt when you read about somebody else's child disappearing, and you feel like you're going through it. My mother, for better or for worse, was oblivious to most of these things. If it happened in Cincinnati, she didn't necessarily know about it. And, you know, things also, I should say, things did go wrong for us. I mean, there were some accidents and injuries. Thankfully, nothing that was, you know, ended our lives or changed them for the worse. So we were lucky. But I do feel very thankful, looking back at this childhood, that I was allowed to have the freedom that I had to explore the world around me, the opportunity to spend that time in the outdoors, particularly the chance to have relationships with animals, horses, whom I loved. And frankly, I loved the cattle, too. And they added a lot to my life. And they were always there. And that backdrop for me absolutely formed my view of the world and myself and my connection to the earth and the other inhabitants.
And that's motivated you to have a small ranch of your own in Wyoming and take your kids there in the summers. Muffy Mead Farrow, she's the author of the new memoir, Its Head Came Off by Accident. She'll be reading tonight, Tuesday, October 30th at 7 o'clock at the King's English Bookshop, 1500 East, 1500 South here in Salt Lake City. And Muffy Mead Farrow, it's a great read. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, haunted houses, spook alleys, and why we love to be scared. You can join us for a Halloween special tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.